Mark, as I said, is or was a fifth generation Mormon, and he now believes that the Mormon belief system is not true. And so he came to the truth and ministers to his people in Utah. I believe you go out there every summer or so for that, to do that. And he's written or produced some real great videos. We actually showed one of his videos called Demolition Evolution. Or Evolution Demolition, yeah. We showed that a number of years ago here. A very good video if you haven't seen that yet. And Mark has another set of short videos that he's producing now called Moment of Truth. And he'll address that, I think, at the end of your talk there. So with that, I'm going to bring Mark up and thank him for being here. Let's introduce Mark. And just remind you that if you're not on our email distribution list, I'm going to pass those around and you can add your name to that.
Thank you, Hines. I think I have this thing switched on. Okay. Wow, it's very humbling to be here. I was honored to be your guest a couple other times, one of which was showing the film that I made, Evolution Demolition, and the other time speaking about Mormonism. But I really consider it an honor to come. It's too bad I can't get here easier. We drove 2.5 hours just coming from Burien tonight, so the traffic was pretty bad. But whenever I've come, it's always really worth it. So I'm really glad to be here. And it's very humbling to speak to you really as a lay person, not a scientist. To think that I'm the warm-up act for Rob Carter is just amazing to me. I really respect that man. He's brilliant. So maybe I can get here next month. I'll just have to plan for a three-hour drive, right? Okay, well, I'm gonna dive right into it. This is a subject that I have become very passionate about. I get excited about evangelism. Mormon people, they're my people, and so they are my passion to share Christ with them. And also, I'm involved with Child Evangelism Fellowship, and I love to share the gospel with children as well. And more recent years, I've gotten excited about sharing Christ with atheists and evolutionists, and I've gotten very excited about the whole topic of creation and evolution. But this very narrow area in particular of entropy is something that I have gotten more excited. Now, you know that I made this film, Evolution Demolition, but that movie was posted on YouTube, and the forum was opened up for discussion there, and so I had the opportunity to have lots of discussion with evolutionists, atheists, some, you know, PhD scientists talking to me about my movie and having dialogue about various topics. And it's really been fun, because I find that I can hold my own with people that are a lot smarter than me. It really helps when you're right, you know. It's really something that I can. And for anybody else who's here as a layperson, you know, take courage, because when you have the truth, you can actually stand up to some of this deception, even though the people you're talking to are very smart people. So I found that especially true with the law of increasing entropy, but that's what we're going to talk about. So what is entropy? Some of the early pioneers of entropy came up with this name for it. They called it mixed upness. That's a pretty good word, especially when you lay it over the top of M&Ms, because that's very mixed up there. Entropy is very much that. It's also randomness would be another word for it, or disorder or chaos. So we're going to talk about mixed upness and entropy tonight. So entropy has to do with what happens over time. Under entropy, over time, everything winds down, wears out, runs down, breaks down, grows old, rusts, decays, deteriorates, disintegrates, disperses, dissolves, dissipates, gets messed up, mixed up, scattered, jumbled, and just made into nonsense. Entropy is a concept. If you're going to understand it, you need to recognize that it's all about arrangement. Arrangement. So you'll need to keep that idea in mind all the way through this. This is very misunderstood, but this is really what entropy is all about, is how things tend to be arranged. And it can be anything. It can be particles, it can be atoms, molecules, marbles, different kinds of energy, photons, energy packets, information. It can be bits, it can be bytes. It really has to do with the arrangement of anything. Not, even though it's called the law of the second law of thermodynamics, it really is much, much bigger than simply thermodynamics. Now you notice on this little diagram up there, I have some other words scattered around arrangement, and that's to illustrate that arrangement is kind of on a continuum. You have the random side, you have the specified side, you have the purposeful side, you have the purposeless side. So it's a continuum of arrangement, and things can fall anywhere on that scale, but to consider it in terms of arrangement. Now, when we talk about things that are arranged, we're not talking about just a few things. In every case, it has to do with something called, basically large numbers, big quantities, large ensembles, that's a term that they use. And so you have lots of whatever it is you're checking on the entropy of. And the reason this is so is because entropy has to do with mathematics a great deal, and it has to do with the law of large numbers. Are any of you familiar with the law of large numbers? Anybody come across that? Okay, one. The law of large numbers basically has to do with what happens, what's the behavior of the entire ensemble as a whole, not just microscopically, but macroscopically. And entropy considers the whole. But as the numbers increase, then the behavior is more predictable for the whole. For example, if you flip a coin two or three times, you really don't know what it's going to come up. You know, it could be any combination of heads or tails, but if you flip a coin maybe 100 times, then it gets a lot closer to the 50-50 ratio. You flip it 1,000 times, 2,000 times, as the number goes up, then it gets closer and closer to that 50-50 probability. The law of large numbers is what determines that. So that's why we're concerned with big groups of whatever the thing is that we're talking about. Also, we're talking about change in the arrangement. And it is spontaneous change that we're concerned with. Not directed change, but change that happens all by itself. This word spontaneous is sometimes misunderstood, but I'm using it to mean that it just means it happens by itself. Okay? And we're also talking about the probabilities of these spontaneous changes happening over time. Time is a very important part of this consideration. The early pioneers of entropy used a term called the arrow of time. And what was determined is that based upon the changes in entropy that happen, you can tell from that alone which way time is running, because everything wears out, winds down, rusts, decays, etc., etc. So, for example, if I have a video like I do in my movie of a wine glass falling on the table and breaking, you can tell if that's playing forwards or backwards very easily, just because there's an arrow of time. You know that little pieces of glass don't all of a sudden jump off the table and form a wine glass. It doesn't work that way. That's against the laws of science. Okay, so now how do you define the law of increasing entropy? Now, I've intentionally called it this instead of the second law of thermodynamics because of what I just mentioned earlier, that it is something that is bigger than simply thermal entropy. But we're going to look at it in the bigger way. So there's a textbook, and I happen to have a copy of it right here, Classical and Modern Physics. This is actually volume 2 of 3 volumes, and I was directed to a page that has 3 different ways that the law can be stated. So these are the ways. Number one, in an isolated system, thermal entropy cannot decrease. Remember, entropy is mixed upness, right? It cannot decrease. It can only get more mixed up. Number two, another way of saying it, in an isolated system, the direction of spontaneous change is from order to disorder. Okay, that's one way of understanding it. And number three is, in an isolated system, the direction of spontaneous change is from an arrangement of lesser probability to an arrangement of greater probability. Now, I think that is the best way to put it, because it is more comprehensive. When you look at the first one, item number one there, it's very, I would call it myopic. It just looks at one little aspect of entropy, thermal entropy, and this last definition, if you will, of the law of increasing entropy is more all-encompassing. It talks about the concept. Now, this is not something that, you know, when we talk about a law, you know, we're not talking about Holy Writ, you know, we're not talking about Scripture, we're not talking about the Constitution or something like that where it's phrased exactly so. As you can see here, scientists have difficulty expressing exactly what this law is. So they have, here's three different ways of doing it. When you're talking with an evolutionist, you're going to run into some difficulties here, because sometimes they want to use their pet definition. Maybe most often what I find is that the scientists tend to be very myopic. They want to look at the small definition rather than the more comprehensive, all-encompassing one. But we're going to keep coming back to the all-encompassing definition, because it gives us greater understanding about what we're talking about. Now, I suppose the question you could ask me is, well, what are your qualifications to talk about this? And I have to kind of shuffle my feet and say, well, not a whole lot. But actually, I think my qualifications for talking tonight are really valid for what we're doing. I'm a layperson, not a scientist. Now, I know a little bit about science. I mean, I had a lot of science in high school. I even had a little bit of college science. Ended up getting my my postgraduate degree in something completely out of the realm of science. But I think I'm a really good critical thinker. I think I have a tendency to think in terms of concepts. You know, when my wife was taking notes in college, she would write down every word the professor said and had pages and pages. And I would sit back and I'd draw a picture to express the sum of the entire lecture. And that's just kind of the way I think. So I believe that I have the ability as a lay person to share something with you tonight that a scientist might not be able to do. And I say that based upon my experience with scientists online, as I've talked to them about this subject. Now, it's amazing to me how many people are afraid of this subject, how many creationists are afraid of it. And evolutionists have these little pat answers they give, these little, you know, one-liners. And then they're ready to move on. They don't want to deal with it. But even creationists, I find that, CMI, an organization that I have great respect for, they tend to kind of not want to go into this. They feel like this is not a real strong topic for creationists to take. And I would respectfully disagree. The more I have studied this, read about entropy, the more excited I get about it. This is really rock solid. This is a law of science. It's not a theory. It's not a hypothesis. We can go there, and it'll be powerful stuff. But I think if as lay people, we can get the big picture, we can get the idea. You know, as I said, scientists want to, they have their magnifying glass out looking at the bark and the leaves on the tree, and I'm looking at the forest. Okay, so tonight we want to look at the forest in terms of entropy. All right, now when I've had dealings with evolutionists, I find some common patterns. This is the biggest fallacy that they ever throw at me, is insults and name-calling. Atheists and evolutionists just love to take that as their approach for dealing with creationists. Anybody here experienced that before? I'll bet you have. If you've ever talked to an atheist, you almost have to have dealt with that, where you get called names and called stupid and everything. I've been told that many times, but I try not to return that in kind when I'm talking with them. They'll call me names and insult me, and then I'll say, okay, Mr. Atheist, so let me get this straight. What you're saying is Mark doesn't know much, therefore evolution must be true. Is that your argument? pretty weak, you know. Ad hominem is a fallacy. So I try and point that out to them, that it is a fallacy. Now, one of these that they throw at me, I don't know how many times I've heard this, is this statement right here. If you think you can disprove a well-accepted theory like evolution, you ought to write a peer-reviewed paper and then go collect your Nobel Prize. I wish I had a nickel for every time an evolutionist told me that. They think that's just such a great way to insult me and throw me off guard, except I've heard it so many times before. But my response to that has got to be, evolution does not need to be disproved by me. Evolution was disproved a long time ago by a foundational, fundamental law of science. I can't add to that. It's already disproved. We're going to go on and take a look at exactly how that is so. All right, well, let's look at a little bit of the history of how this whole idea came about. There's a man named Rudolf Clausius, who's pretty much the father of thermal entropy, thermodynamics, and he defined entropy. And he defined it, well, he talked about mixed upness, but also he defined it in a thermal sense. With this formula, the change in entropy is equal to basically the heat that is lost in the process to the environment divided by the absolute temperature, or degrees Kelvin. And so that was his basic formula that he came up with. But here's the thinking that he was doing. When he came up with that, he had this kind of an idea in mind. And we've all seen this, where we get a cup of hot coffee or hot chocolate, we set it on the counter, and after a while, it gets to room temperature, right? The heat in the coffee goes out of the coffee and into the surroundings. It never goes the other way. He noticed this. It's a one-way trip. It's the arrow of time. With entropy, it's always getting greater. And so that's the basic idea of thermal entropy, is you can see it right there in that diagram. Okay. Now, not too many years later, that was in 1850 or so, when he wrote his paper presenting his definition of entropy. Then comes Ludwig Boltzmann in 1871. Now, 1871 is a little significant, because what happened 12 years earlier? Darwin, right? Origin of Species came out. This is only 12 years later that he's just absolutely demolishing evolution, except he didn't realize he had done that, but he really had. Ludwig Boltzmann studied entropy from a different angle. He came at it from mathematics, not from the coffee cup and the heat. He used something called statistical mechanics. Statistical mechanics is a branch of mathematics dealing with the probability of arrangement in space and time. It is basically mathematics. And he invented this idea along with his collaborators, Maxwell and Gibbs, and they came up with this, basically this discipline of mathematics called statistical mechanics. But it is mathematics, and he comes at it dealing with probabilities, with counting stuff, and he arrived at something very interesting. Now, because probabilities are so important to understanding what Boltzmann did, I want to take just a quick detour here and talk about probability. I don't know how much math all of you have had, or statistics. I had a fair amount of math, but it was a long time ago, so I don't remember much of it. But let's look at some just really basic stuff. First of all, this idea of what probability is mathematically. What is the probability of zero? That means it's impossible, right? A probability of one means that something is a certainty, and anything in between would be whatever that probability is, but it's a fraction between zero and one. So what's the probability of flipping a coin and getting heads? What? 0.5, or 50%, or 0.5, right? And so the probability of getting tails is also going to be that same thing. How about the probability of rolling a 2 with a die? That's going to be 1/6, right? Since there's 6 faces on a die. Or the probability of rolling something other than a 2 is going to be 5/6, Okay, you got the idea. That's how probabilities are defined in math. So it's basically a fraction. It's this idea of the target divided by the number of possibilities, and so that's what gives you your fraction. All right, now let's look at some examples of how you calculate probability. And please excuse my chest cold. I just got hit with this today. I'm really frustrated. I hope it doesn't affect my talking. But I don't have a frog in my throat. It's a primitive amphibious life form. Okay. So what if you have a pot of alphabet soup on the stove and you dip your spoon into it and you get the word win in your spoon? Well, what are the odds of that happening? What are the probabilities? Okay, well, let's make some assumptions here that the pot is full of every letter of the alphabet, and there's plenty of each of those letters. So the probabilities would be one chance in 26 of getting a W, one chance in 26 of getting an I, one chance in 26 of getting an N. So the probability of getting the whole word, you would multiply those together. So it's one chance in 17,576, which the fraction would be 0.0000569. Okay? That's just a simple calculation for a simple probability for a little three-letter word. Okay, if it's a four-letter word, you add another 26 to it, the number jumps to 456,000, so it's one chance in 456,000 instead. So you see the numbers go up rather quickly as soon as you add letters to the alphabet, or to your spoonful there. Okay, now this won't fit in a spoon, so you just have to look at it on the surface of the pot. You have a five-letter word. What are the odds of that? Now you're up to 11 million, one chance in 11 million. Thank you. So that is 0.0000000084. Did I count the number of zeros right? Now, how about when you start to get a phrase like tea time? What are the odds of that happening? Remember, spontaneously. You're not making this happen. You're just kind of letting it bubble up to the surface of the pot. What are the odds of that happening? Well, it's one chance in about 2 billion. Not very likely, is it? As those numbers go up, like what if you were going to have your alphabet soup spell out an entire sentence? Or like maybe even the recipe for alphabet soup? What are the odds for that? Well, Douglas Axe had a name for that. He called it fantastically improbable. What that means is even though you technically would say that it's possible because the number is greater than zero, it's not much greater than zero. It effectively is zero because the number is so incredibly big in the denominator. So fantastically improbable. Like I calculated this number in the movie Evolution Demolition for a simple protein. In that case, your alphabet basically is 20 amino acids, and the simplest protein that I could find was 125 amino acids long. So that's a simple matter of taking 20 to 125th power, and you get this number 4 times 10 to the 162nd power, actually the minus 162nd power. Well, there's only 10 to the 80th power atoms in the universe, estimated. So that's fantastically improbable, right? But you see how these probabilities really mount very, very quickly. Okay, probabilities are a key part of what Boltzmann was calculating as he's doing statistical mechanics to look at all the different possible arrangements of things. And so he understood this principle about probabilities, and he came up with this formula. And if you look at that formula, if you haven't had math, it might be a little mysterious to you. You see kind of right in the middle of it, there's this kind of like an E or backwards 3, that's a sigma. That is the symbol for summation. So that basically means this is a counting formula. So Boltzmann is going to count up all of these different, he calls them states, or different possible arrangements. And then he's going to take that by the logarithm just because he wants to account for how this complexity leaps as you increase the quantities. But basically what you're looking at is a counting thing. And he's counting up the probabilities of all the arrangements. And when he did this, he found that there was this proportionality that goes back to what Clausius had discovered. And so he plugs in a constant, that K number, and he found out it comes to the exact same thing that Clausius had come up with for for thermal entropy. He just needed, remember Clausius, his number was in joules per degree Kelvin. This didn't have any units, it was just a count, right? But he plugged in a constant that is in joules per degrees Kelvin, and when you add that or multiply that constant, then you come up with exactly the same result. So what Boltzmann did was he verified that thermal entropy is actually a statistical mechanics thing. It's not a heat thing. Okay? You get that? This is a giant thing to understand, and evolutionists so often completely miss this. Even really smart ones with lots of letters after their name. But entropy has to do with math. It's this counting thing. Okay? Now, see, when Boltzmann was studying this, he wasn't really studying heat. He was studying the behavior of gases in containers and how they, you know, the molecules of gas bounce around in the room. And that's how he came up with this formula. So he wasn't even really looking at heat to come up with the logic of doing this. And brilliantly, you know, he arrived at this proof, just verifying the law. Okay, now if we go almost 80 years later, we have another gentleman named Claude Shannon in 1948. He's an information scientist. He starts applying the same logic to information bits, and he finds the same kind of relationship. Now, he's not concerned about converting it into joules per degree Kelvin, so his formula doesn't have a constant in front of it, but it's the same idea. It's a counting thing, and he takes it to the log to account for the complexities as you increase in the numbers of these arrangements. But it's the same basic idea. And now, the interesting thing about information, it's a little different than, I'm going to take a drink of that water here. Information is based on the idea of contingency. When you see a word spelled out somewhere, you don't assume that that's the only way that could be. You're assuming that somebody specified those particular letters because they wanted to send you a particular message. Information is all about contingency. You have to have a medium that carries the message or stores the message. And so this formula for entropy can actually be applied to both the medium or to the contents of the information itself, but both carry the same idea of entropy. So when we talk about the medium, you're actually talking about really the effectively you're talking about noise or static that muddles a message, you see? This is informational entropy. Okay, you getting the idea here? So now, like, if we apply this to, say, a beach, you can look at the entropy of the entire beach, and it's massive, you know, very, very high disorder on the way the sand is all distributed. The message that you write with your finger in the sand is a very low entropy item because it's very, very specified. Okay, are we on board here? But it's the same idea, it's the same math that goes with all of this. Okay, now information in living things is especially important because it is fundamentally functional information. Now, here's some things about functional information. Functional information is characterized by specified complexity, which means that it's highly complex, highly coherent, and highly functional all at the same time. It's not merely descriptive information. You know, like if you were to snap a picture of something, you'd say, well, that describes what I just took a picture of. But it's functional, and it's actually prescriptive. It's giving instructions in living things, isn't it? Secondly, it's difficult, notoriously difficult to measure information at all. When you're talking about Shannon information, that really had to do with just kind of the background or the medium. But in this case, when you're talking about functional information, I recently heard a podcast, and he described it this way. It's measured by how many conceivable ways the functionality of the code could be broken. In other words, the more things that can go wrong with it, that means there must be more information in there. Okay? And that's a pretty good descriptor, because if you just tamper with you know, critical information that has lots of intricate function. You tamper with it just a little bit and it messes the whole thing up. That means there's a lot of functional information in that. Okay, now so entropy, when it concerns information, I want to assert that it is always deleterious. It's always bad for the information. It doesn't mean it's always bad for the organism, because once in a while doing something bad to the information might help things for the organism, such as in the case of the malaria and sickle cell mutation that's actually damaged to hemoglobin, but it's so much damage that the malaria protists don't even like it. And so it might protect the person from getting malaria, but of course he could get sickle cell disease. So it's not a good thing informationally, but it might be a good thing for the organism. By the way, mutations have been described as being an accident, a genetic accident. And I try and explain that when you're talking about a beneficial mutation. If Hitler's car crashes, isn't that a beneficial mutation? You see, but it's still damage, right? Okay, this is the same kind of concept when we're talking about the genes. Now, the book Genetic Entropy by John Sanford, I don't know how many of you have read that book, but it's fascinating and it very much relates to this. But he was open to the idea that maybe, possibly, a mutation might sometime actually generate a little bit of information. And I would assert that I don't think so. I think the only beneficial mutations we get are like this malaria thing with the sickle cell. My opinion, it'd be difficult to prove either way, but okay, so now we're back to this concept again. I want to keep coming back. Entropy has to do with arrangement. In an isolated system, the direction of spontaneous change is from an arrangement of lesser probability to an arrangement of greater probability. Okay, another way that I've stated it to evolutionists is this: random begets random. Random doesn't beget order. If you are applying, and mutations are random, right? That's random change. So random can never produce anything but more random, even more random than it was. Okay, we've talked about Clausius, we've talked about Boltzmann, we've talked about Shannon. I want to introduce another man to you that is contemporary now. He's Granville Sewall. He's a professor of mathematics at UTEP. And he kind of talks in a droning kind of voice, and he's not real interesting in terms of his voice, but the content of what he says, wow, he's got some really great things to say. And he wrote three papers that are very powerful. I've got them with me if you would like to look at them later. These are, you know, peer-reviewed papers that he wrote. We're going to talk about these in just a minute, about some of the key ideas in these three papers. But this is up to date now. So we're talking about 2001, 2011, 2013 for these papers. Now, we're going to come back to him. But the law of increasing entropy, as I said, carries with it a lot of objections, misunderstandings. Creationists have misunderstandings, but certainly evolutionists have misunderstandings. Let's start with kind of the king of militant atheists, Richard Dawkins. So Richard Dawkins says, when creationists say, as they frequently do, that the theory of evolution contradicts the second law of thermodynamics, they are telling us no more than that they don't understand the second law ad hominem. There is no contradiction because of the sun. Gee, all my questions are answered. Are they for you too? This is just a deflection. He doesn't want to go there. He doesn't want to talk about the actual problem that he's got. Now, what he's going to, I mean, one of the papers that Granville Sewall wrote, he asked this question: are we supposed to believe that anything can happen in an open system? You know, hocus pocus, anything goes in an open system? You know, that's not the idea. Like I said, we're not talking about holy writ. We're talking about an attempt to describe a principle. Okay, get the principle, and then you will have it. Don't parse words and try and find loopholes like you're a lawyer. That's what he's doing. He says, this is an open system, and so if we have the Son, it's no longer open. Oh, I don't have to pay any attention to you anymore. But he didn't address anything. Okay, Granville Sewall. Oh, boy, I'm sorry about my voice. He described a tautology. It is this. If an increase in order is extremely improbable when a system is closed, it is still improbable when the system is open, unless something is entering which makes it not extremely improbable. And you might add the word duh, because that's a pretty obvious thing. I mean, he says it's a tautology. It should be an obvious thing, but apparently to Richard Dawkins, it's not. So if order walks in the door of a system, that's one thing. But when you're talking about the sun, there's no order in sunlight. It's extremely random. It has no way of bringing order into the system. So what we effectively have is evolutionists are really great at making excuses, not so good at making explanations. That's what's going on with Richard Dawkins here. He explains absolutely nothing, because we still have the problem that we started with. Now, Granville Sewall gives us a couple of scenarios that helps us with this. So let's imagine two scenarios. The first scenario is that we have a tornado that comes down with great energy and hits a house, and it turns the house into a pile of rubble. Okay, we can understand that. Here's the second scenario. Another tornado of equal high energy comes in and strikes the pile of rubble and builds a house. Now, how do we know which one is true and which one is false? Because the law applies no matter what. It doesn't matter whether it's an open or closed system. Both of those are open systems. But according to Richard Dawkins, the tornado ought to be able to build the house because it's an open system, right? That just solves everything. No, not at all. Because that's not the only thing you need. Energy is fine. Energy can come from the outside, but actually energy can come from within the system. But you need something more than just that. We're gonna get to that in just a second. There's another lame excuse that goes right along with the sun excuse, and that's the compensation excuse. And the way this goes is the evolutionists will say, well, we acknowledge that living things have very low entropy, amazing complexity and function, and we acknowledge that. But that's very possible because all you have to do is compensate for that decrease in entropy in that living thing, and it is offset by an increase in entropy somewhere else, and then we've got the problem solved. And again, what's being said there is, okay, we've parsed the words and we've found a legal loophole, but they haven't really explained what's going on. Compensation does not work. Now, if we go back to our original idea of what entropy is, entropy is relational. It has to do with arrangement. And if entropy is relational, that means that the entropy before and after is connected. It's not a compensation situation. There has to be a connection. You have to have a transfer of entropy. And Granville Sewall wrote about this idea. He called it exentropy, where entropy would be transferred across some kind of a boundary between subsystems. But the entropy has to go somewhere. It's not just magically popping up on the other side of the universe. Okay? So evolutionists have explained nothing when they just give the compensation argument. Okay. I told you I'd get back to this. There are conditions for transferring entropy. Here's what they are. First, you need an input of energy from the sun, or actually even from within the system. But secondly, you need an ETM to harness that energy. An ETM is something I've coined myself. When I talk to evolutionists about this online, they say, what book did you get that from? I said, I made that up. An ETM is short for energy transfer mechanism. You must have some kind of mechanism for transferring that energy, for harnessing it to build what you want to build. Let's go back to the tornado scenarios. The first scenario is no problem. We all know a tornado can ruin a house, but what if you took the equal amount of a tornado, the equal amount of energy of a tornado, and put it into carpenters, and then let the carpenters rebuild the house from the pile of rubble? Would that be believable? Yeah, a lot more so. Why is that? Because those carpenters are an entropy transfer mechanism. They are altering the probabilities. Entropy has everything to do with probabilities. Remember, this is the definition in an isolated system. The direction of spontaneous change is from an arrangement of lesser probability to an arrangement of greater probability. So following the probabilities is where entropy goes. And so if you have an entropy transfer mechanism, you can alter those probabilities. That's exactly what photosynthesis does. Photosynthesis is an entropy transfer mechanism. It takes the energy of the sun and carbon dioxide, and it puts those together, and it manufactures plant tissue and energy for the plant. That is an entropy transfer mechanism. Now, some evolutionists have incorrectly complained that we creationists don't believe that you can ever do anything about the law of increasing entropy, and therefore we're just closing a blind eye to the fact that living things exist. Well, of course, that's ridiculous. We believe that entropy can be transferred because living things do exist. We're not denying that. What I'm saying is, show me the entropy transfer mechanism that is building up the genome. They don't have anything. It's a deafening silence when I ask them that question. The only mechanism they have going on is random mutations. What does a random process give you? Random begets random, right? Random can never beget anything else. So until the day that an evolutionist can give us at least a proposal for a theoretical entropy transfer mechanism that could build up the genome into this amazingly complex set of instructions that we find in DNA and in other places in living things, they've got nothing. They've got no way to deal with the law of increasing entropy. You with me so far? Okay. Granville Sewell also pointed out something that we've really come across already, that entropy is not just thermal. Now, for example, consider a bar of steel. We can see thermal entropy happening in that bar of steel if we heat one end of it, and then we wait, and we watch that temperature gradient to spread out evenly throughout the whole bar of steel, and eventually the rest of it gets a little bit warmer and the hot part becomes cooler and it all evens out, right? That is thermal entropy. But you know, steel also contains a little bit of chromium in there. And if the chromium is not distributed evenly, did you know that in a steel bar, over a longer period of time, of course, but over time, the chromium will actually distribute itself evenly throughout that steel bar? Did you know that? He pointed this out and said this is an example of non-thermal entropy. There are lots of examples of that. Boltzmann gave us the one of the behavior of gases. And we're going to talk about gases in just a second here too. Okay, now let me go to another objection by a famous evolutionist. He died in 97, Dr. George Wald. He is a Nobel laureate. And he said this, speaking about evolution, by the way, he said, "Time itself performs miracles. Given enough time, it will almost certainly happen at least once. Time is, in fact, the hero of the plot. Given so much time, the impossible becomes possible. The possible probable, and the probable virtually certain. One has only to wait. Time itself performs the miracles." And I have to ask the question, you're a Nobel laureate. Do you have the slightest clue about entropy? Because entropy contains in it the concept of the arrow of time. I don't know if he just wasn't thinking about it. I think that's typically what happens. I don't think these guys are dumb. I think they just turn away and they don't want to consider it. But there is an arrow of time in entropy. Everything gets more disorderly. It doesn't go back the other way. Time is not the hero of the plot. It's the enemy of the plot. Time is the very thing that destroys evolution because entropy is real, and time is a part of that. Now, according to Dr. George Wald, if you start with a planet that looks something like this, and then a few billion years of this, then you get this. I mean, he's really saying that. It's bizarre. When scientists ignore science, that's the title of my talk. Well, here's a classic example of it, and I've given you a couple of others. This is not science. This is bibbidi-bobbidi-boo. Now, see, I am not trying to be insulting here. I am simply saying they're ignoring, they're turning a blind eye to what foundational laws of science say. Okay, now remember, I said if you're going to make alterations in entropy, you're going to reduce it. You have to have an input of energy. You have to have an energy transfer mechanism to harness that energy. And so that would be the case with a planet that was devoid of life. And you're going to apply an entropy transfer mechanism. You know, the book of Genesis gives us the grandest entropy transfer mechanism ever. His name is I Am, the Lord God Almighty. And he can change all the probabilities. That doesn't mean that he didn't establish that law. He did. And he's not pulling the law out from under us. He's not. But he can change the probabilities. And remember that in an isolated system, the direction of spontaneous change is from an arrangement of lesser probability to an arrangement of greater probability. Okay, now I want to get a little more practical here. Do you realize that entropy is part of our lives constantly? Every day of our lives, we deal with entropy without even really thinking about it. How about an example in the kitchen? Let's say you're making a salad. You want the salad all mixed up. Do you have to go and calculate that? No, you just toss it and you expect it to become homogenized in the mixture that it is and get all mixed up, which is just what you want, right? That's the law of increasing entropy. You're never going to toss a salad and have it all sort everything out. Now, I have to add a caveat there. There are conditions where you have either physical properties or natural laws that can do a certain amount of natural sorting, but that would be according to the probabilities that are inherent in those natural laws or those physical properties. But in the case of salad, nothing keeping that separated. You toss it, it's getting mixed. Okay, I want to give you an object lesson here. Canned air. Okay, you guys have used these before, right? To clean off your computer and everything. Now, this carries the idea of probability gradients. When the probabilities are different in one subsystem from another subsystem, we have our law that says it wants to get arranged in the most probable way possible, right? Now, the air molecules in this can are very condensed, and so the probabilities are much lower that this air would be in this state. The air in the room is a much higher probability, and so the air in this can desperately wants to get out of this can and mix up with the air in this room. So when I allow it to and I open the valve, I don't have to force anything. Look what happens. I mean, it comes out in a hurry. But when I push that button and open that valve, why doesn't more air in the room get sucked back into the can? You know, I'm running out of compressed air. Come on, get in there, air. Why won't it go in? You know, obviously, it's the law. And it's a mathematical law. Did you ever imagine that there's some force in here that's forcing the air out? No, it's not. Now, there's four forces in physics, right, Heinz? The strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, gravity, and electromagnetism. I don't know about the compressed air force, but actually there's still a law of mathematics. It's more probable for this air to get out than it is to come back in. And so, you know what makes the air come out of this can? Math! It does, and math actually is like a force. It's a probability gradient actually creates something akin to a force, because the law says that it wants to equalize those probabilities. So next time you're doing something like that, or yeah, you can tell your mom when you're mixing the salad that you're doing math. Okay. Now, there are other really amazing examples of this. Probability gradients actually are everywhere. Here's a diagram of one, and I wish we could go into this in depth. There's a little bit of a mention of it in my movie, Evolution Demolition. But this is the ATP synthase molecule. It's actually a turbine engine that manufactures ATP from ADP molecules. That's important because ATP is the energy currency of life. Every cell in every living thing needs ATP to get its energy from. And so this is how it's manufactured. It's in an organelle in a cell called the mitochondria, and there's a membrane, and this actually many of these little turbine motors are connected on that membrane, and so this motor needs power. So what do you suppose makes the motor turn? It actually goes 12,000 RPMs. It's actually a mechanical force that causes the ADP to turn into ATP. To combine, what is it, a phosphate, I think, that hooks on there to do that. But what powers the motor? It's a probability gradient, just like the can of air, because on the outside of the membrane, there's a higher concentration of hydrogen ions or protons than there is on the inside. And so the probability gradient makes those protons want to get past that membrane. But the only pathway that's given to it is through the ATP synthase molecule. And there's a turbine in there, and it powers that motor. And so as those protons flow through that motor, it gets up to 12,000 RPMs, and there are trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions of these in every living thing, and every bit of life depends on it. Do you realize how foundational the law of increasing entropy is to the existence of all life? I know there's some creationists who have suggested that it's that maybe when the fall happened that's when God invented the law of increasing entropy. I really don't think that's the case, because it's too inherent in every bit of life. We need the law of increasing entropy. It's math. And math, if anything, expresses the character of God. He is so amazingly mathematical in his character, in his nature. And I believe that's why this law works. Now, as I said, God can change probabilities, and I think that's how he engineered the fall. But I don't think he invented the law of increasing entropy at the fall. We need it. It's part of everything we do. All right, now let me get across another idea, and that's this idea of constraints. When something becomes more random, as the law requires, there can be constraints on that randomization that are caused by physical properties or natural laws. An example might be rainfall that comes down just scattered all over the place, but when it hits the ground, it's channeled into riverbeds, right? The physical properties of the landscape that it falls on channels that water into specific places. Well, that is not a reduction in randomness. That's just putting constraints on the randomness. And there are lots of examples of that. Here's another way of explaining it, kind of like a funnel. You can have physical constraints on randomness. Nevertheless, what is within those constraints is random. But actually putting constraints on things is exactly how an entropy transfer mechanism works, is that it channels this entropy. Okay, so that's just a concept I wanted to communicate. When I'm talking to atheist evolutionists, I think they think that I'm saying that everything always has to be totally random, and that's not the case. There can be constraints. In fact, there almost always are some kind of constraints, usually like the boundary for a given system. Okay. For example, the air in this room, it's kind of contained within these walls, right? If we had a big wind outside, we wouldn't feel it in here. Yes, it can leak out in a few places, but basically we've got boundaries. So the air in here can become more random, but it's still constrained within the walls. For example, all of the oxygen in this room, theoretically, could go all over into that corner over there, and all the nitrogen would be everywhere else. And then you wouldn't have any oxygen to breathe, and you would die. Are you worried about it? No, because the law of increasing entropy says that's going to get homogenized in with all the molecules in this room. You're going to have an equal distribution of oxygen everywhere in this room, so you're safe. Isn't that cool? So constraints and yet randomness within the constraints, okay? Okay, I want to finish out by talking about three epic entropy fails of evolution. Here they are. Long, complex, delicate molecules break apart. They don't build up spontaneously. Okay, life is made of these kind of molecules. Protein molecules are very, very long, complex. They want to break apart. They don't want to just come together. DNA, RNA, same thing. Entropy makes life, or makes evolution just flat out not possible. Second epic fail, information-rich sequences in DNA spontaneously jumble rather than spontaneously programming themselves. Mutations don't build things, they break things. So not only in the molecule physically, but in the information contained in the molecule, the law of increasing entropy makes both of those things a problem. Thirdly, natural selection does the opposite of preserving anything. It spontaneously culls and kills. Okay, so here's three different ways, any one of which would make evolution fail, but here's three things where it fails at every step. Now remember, the Neo-Darwinian model is that you have natural selection acting upon random mutations over long periods of time. That's their mechanism, right? That's supposed to be getting the job done. But if we look at these epic fails, we see that it can't possibly happen. For example, that first epic fail we were talking about, the molecule itself. Here's just a really small part of a DNA. The DNA molecule. It's about 15 nucleotides right there. 15 rungs on the ladder. But you can see how many atoms are involved there. I like this model because it shows all the atoms, not just, you know, whether it's a cytosine or a, you know, thymine or whatever the nucleobase base is, but it shows all the atoms in it so you can see the complexity of it. You basically have two sugar spines and then you have these bases that are connecting across like rungs of the ladder. So here's 15 of those. But did you know human DNA is 3 billion nucleotide pairs? If it's all wound up, but if you were to stretch it out, it would be 6 feet long. One molecule. Now that one molecule, do you think it's fragile if you were to stretch it out? You think if you were able to grab it, of course you can't even see it because it's so thin, but if you could see it enough to take hold of two parts of it, you think you have any problem just snapping it? No. It's fragile. It breaks apart very easily. It takes a lot to build up those things. It takes incredible machinery inside the cell to do that. Same way with virtually all these molecules. You know, RNA would be copied from it, but proteins have to be manufactured from the DNA information, transcribed, and so on. So proteins, same issue. You've got all these amino acids strung together just in a perfect way, a perfect sequence, so that they will fold up properly like an origami, and then it will do the function that it needs to do. This is just foundational to what life is all about. They're very delicate. Now, there's a limited amount of things that scientists can do in a laboratory to try and build these things. And when they go to great lengths, sometimes they can build molecules that are a little bit complex, but nothing that will happen spontaneously out in nature, and whatever they build is immediately fragile and weak and wants to break apart again right away. So if we have such a hard time making these things, why would you assume that they would randomly happen by accident? Doesn't make any sense. It's a direct violation of the law of increasing entropy, isn't it? That's just the physical chaining together of atoms in this long molecule. But the information content, that's where it just gets so amazing. Because it is the order of these bases, the rungs of the ladder, that programs everything. The way that those things are ordered is not ordered by any kind of physical law or natural process, because all of those bonds are approximately equal. So there's nothing that, and even if there was something that would make it do that, to order them in a certain way, it seems to me like it would sort it. It would put all of one kind of a base in one part of the DNA and all of another kind in another part and so on. There's no way that it's going to specify the kind of sequences we find, because exactly the way those sequences are determines whether I'm a human or a sponge. You know, you order them differently and I'm a sponge. Now, there's only a few ways that you can order all those nucleobases and I'll still be a living human. There's a whole lot of ways you can order those nucleobases and I'll be dead. See what I'm saying about probabilities? Remember the probability calculations we were doing earlier? It is so rare, and this is a word that comes up again and again as I study the evolution creation debate, is what God has made is so rare. It's so improbable for it to happen by itself. It has to be directed. It's the only possible way. And as Douglas Axe said, it would be fantastically improbable. There are not enough atoms in the universe. There are not enough nanoseconds in even their idea of the length of the time that the universe has existed. There are not enough resources in the universe to give us enough trials to make even the simplest stuff happen like this. So how can it be that we're going from a less probable arrangement to a more probable arrangement when this stuff is so improbable? It's a direct violation of a foundational law of science. And I don't think we should let the evolutionists off the hook anymore. The last point that I'm going to close with has to do with the idea of preservatives. Now, we use that word, we talk about something being a preservative. Maybe it has to do with putting salt in the meat as a preservative, or maybe we're going to put a specimen in a jar of formaldehyde. Or maybe we're going to use cryogenics, we're going to freeze it to preserve it. But do any of these things actually preserve living tissue? No. All they do is slow it way down. That's the best we can do. Remember, the law says you can't preserve it. It's going to decay, disperse, get more random. There's no such thing as a true preservative. There's only ways to slow it down for a given period of time. And by the way, one of my Moment of Truth videos talks about the science behind this. Tissue preservation is something that is well studied, and they have found that theoretically they think that they can't reproduce it in the laboratory, but theoretically they think that living tissue could last 900,000 years, but they've never been able to produce any kind of condition that would match that. By the way, the kind of time frames that they're talking about, it's way more than 900,000 years, because that's less than a million. They're talking about tens, even hundreds of millions of years. But things cannot last that long. So what are we doing with dinosaur soft tissue that's not fossilized, but is original tissue? The decay happens, but it has happened long enough that it's still there, so we know that the Earth can't be that old. That's just a little thing I threw in for free. Okay, so there are no such things as true preservatives. There are only things that slow it down. But this is interesting, because what did Darwin say about natural selection? He called it a preservative. Okay, let's watch a video if I can get this thing set up. And I will show you what I'm talking about.
said that in China you can't question the government, but you're allowed to question Darwin. On the other hand, in America, you are very free to question the government, but you can't question Darwin. Well, in this episode, we are not going to rock Darwin's boat. We're going to sink it. Darwin's famous book, Origin of Species, actually had a longer title than that. If we look at the 1859 title page, we read, On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. Preservation? Whoa! Hold on just a minute. This word is very important. Is natural selection a preservative? Assuming that Darwin's term favored races is a reference to favored biological variations, let me ask that question again. Does the very real phenomenon of natural selection preserve mutated life? Darwin got this completely backwards. Natural selection filters, culls, and kills. It does anything but preserve. Coherent networks of biological systems that already exist in an organism certainly cause organisms to survive and reproduce. But natural selection is all about the death of the unfit. Natural selection does not preserve. Instead, it destroys members of a population with low survival value or reproductive value. This is observable science. Give this a little thought and you will realize that Darwin hung his entire argument on this concept that natural selection can accomplish preservation of variations. It's right there in his book title. But he was wrong. Completely, utterly wrong. Of course we see natural selection in operation everywhere in the biological world. Weak things die. So what? If viable biological systems did not already exist before natural selection selects anything, there could be no survival of anything. So natural selection can only serve as a filter, removing the unfit. It culls out the weak, removes variations that cannot already reproduce. But has a culling mechanism ever grown lumber? Has an operation that culls oranges ever created an orange? Does culling garbage build anything? The fact is that natural selection works more like a doctor whose only tool is a shotgun. Now, such a doctor could shoot all the sick people and possibly claim that he'd transformed the remaining population to wellness. And by the way, even this idea assumes that a wide variety of other dangers besides the bad mutations didn't ever kill the healthy people. But in any case, shooting sick people doesn't help individuals evolve into X-Men. Not even slightly. Conclusion? If natural selection did somehow act as a preservative, many obstacles to evolution would still remain. But given that natural selection culls rather than preserves, well, the evolution model is rendered powerless from the outset. What about you? Have you been assuming that natural selection preserves life forms? Think again. Evolution is impossible for many reasons, but it only takes one.
So I am now doing these shorter videos instead of, you know, like the full-length feature that I did with Evolution Demolition, and hopefully I'm getting a little more views that way, because people don't tend to want to sit that long. But I have a whole series of videos there at momentoftruth.info, and my next one is going to be on entropy, so hopefully that will be ready for you within a couple weeks. A lot of it will be based on what I presented to you tonight. So that is my presentation, and I